I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The idea of using science and technology to control the weather is not a new one. Almost 200 years ago, an American meteorologist named James Pollard Espy, also known as the Storm King, dreamed up the idea of creating rain by doing controlled burning of forests. This is an early example of geoengineering, defined as the deliberate intervention in the Earth's natural systems to influence and control weather and climate. Today, there is growing interest in geoengineering because of rising global temperatures and weather extremes associated with climate change and because of the inertia on the part of nations to cut CO2 emissions. While some are enthusiastic about the potential benefits of geoengineering, others are skeptical and worry about unintended consequences. It's our topic for today's Radio Times. We have two guests who join us by telephone. Jeff Goodall is a journalist and contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. He won the Grantham Prize Award of Special Merit for his most recent book, How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering and the Audacious Quest to Fix the Earth's Climate. Jeff Goodall, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Alan Robach. He's a climatologist at Rutgers University in the Department of Environmental Sciences. He is the author of hundreds of articles and peer review papers. And Alan Robach, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us, Alan. Let me begin with you, if I could. And would it be fair to say, Alan Robach, that we are already doing geoengineering in that we have pumped, what, hundreds of billions of tons of CO2 into the atmosphere?
No. The definition of geoengineering is intentional climate change. We are certainly causing the climate to change by putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, but it's for the purpose of cooking our food and driving our cars. It's not for the purpose of controlling the planet's climate. And so geoengineering includes this intention as part of it.
Do you see it that way, Jeff?
Yeah, I understand what Alan's saying, but I would argue perhaps that we've known that putting CO2 into the atmosphere is having a big impact on the climate for several decades now. So you could certainly argue that there's some intentionality right now in this act of burning fossil fuels.
Alan, even going back to you, you were a guest on the show about, three, four, 5 years ago when everyone seemed to be talking about geoengineering. Then it seemed to go underground, and now it seems to be back. What do you think explains that?
From my point of view, it hasn't gone underground at all. The research has just been going on more and more, and there's been more and more interest in it. So ever since Paul Crutzen wrote his article in 2006 that saying we might have to consider geoengineering, and he has a Nobel Prize, it sort of got rid of the taboo about talking about it, and there's been more and more research interest ever since.
And Jeff, you have been covering environmental issues for some time now. Do you see this issue as being a kind of a constant or having an ebb and flow?
Well, I think that it's actually the interest is renewing now because of two factors. One is this extreme weather that everyone is seeing now. I think this sort of debate about whether climate change is actually happening that, you know, we've been absorbed in for the last 20 years or so is pretty much over. I think people are seeing it with their own eyes. You know, Hurricane Sandy was certainly a landmark in that moment. And I think the other thing that's happened is that despite, 20 or 30 years of talking about cutting CO2 emissions, it's pretty clear that we're not doing it, certainly not on a global scale. So I think the conversation is turning now to what are other strategies we might use to reduce the risk of climate change.
But, Alan, do you see this as an act of desperation to try to slow the warming of the planet?
The way I look at it is that we have this idea of something we might try, but we really don't understand the risks or the benefits well enough to even make a decision about whether to do it. So what we really need is a lot more study so that we can make an informed decision sometime in the future. But yes, it would be an act of desperation. There is still not very much push toward mitigation, toward reducing the greenhouse gas emissions, especially from China and India. China passed the U.S. 6 years ago in their amount of carbon dioxide pollution to the atmosphere, and now their emissions are 53% greater than the United States. So it's zooming up and up and up, And it's what they do and what they choose to do to bring their people to a better lifestyle without dumping CO2 in the atmosphere. If they make that decision and work hard toward it, that will be more important than what the U.S. does.
And even more important than what anyone figures out when it comes to geoengineering?
Geoengineering would be so dangerous if there's no mitigation. The only reasonable idea of ever using it is in concert with mitigation to shave off the worst, most dangerous aspects of climate change. But if there's no mitigation, geoengineering would not save us at all.
Do you see it that way, Jeff?
Well, I certainly agree that without that, you know, the problem of climate change is caused by too much greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and the solution is to reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But since we're failing to do that, you know, we do have to look at these other strategies. And it's certainly the idea of doing geoengineering as some kind of a quick fix or sort of a diet pill for the planet is a nightmare scenario. But just because it's a nightmare scenario doesn't mean it won't happen.
Indeed. But are you talking about a nightmare scenario in that we don't understand whatever we would do, we cannot anticipate the unintended consequences?
Right. I mean, we've never done anything like this before. And as Alan knows very well, the closest analog is, you know, volcanic eruptions. And he's, you know, one of the world's leading experts in that. But even those are not a perfect analog for, you know, the way that sulfate particles in the atmosphere can reduce sunlight and cool off the planet. So it is it's uncharted terrain. But, you know, it may be uncharted terrain that we're forced to head into by political crisis related to the effects of climate change.
What, because nations are not willing to the kind of mitigation that Alan was talking about?
Right. And one, I mean, there's various scenarios one can imagine where, you know, we get into India or China, or for that matter, even the United States gets into excessive prolonged droughts. We get into food supply shortages, and all of a sudden there's, you know, a lot of political pressure to do something about this and to try to sort of fix the climate. And, you know, even if it doesn't make sense scientifically, it may make sense politically to try to do something quick to cool off the planet, and that's where we get into dangerous scenarios.
Mm. Well, let me go back to you, if I can, Alan Roebuck, and I know that you are a skeptic, but nonetheless, we've been talking in generalities. Give us an example of a form of geoengineering.
Well, I'm a skeptic because I'm a scientist, but I'm an agnostic as far as geoengineering. I still think if it works, there would be potential benefits, and we have to weigh those against the risks, and we just don't know well enough what those risks and benefits are to make a decision. So the two ideas that are most suggested are to create a cloud in the stratosphere, the layer of air above where we live, just like volcanic eruptions do, made out of tiny sulfuric acid droplets, to reflect sunlight and cool the planet. And volcanoes emit sulfur dioxide gas once in a big puff like Mount Pinatubo did 22 years ago. This idea is to continuously replenish that cloud to keep it there because it lasts for a couple years. The other idea is to sail ships around the ocean and to spray salt up into low clouds over the ocean to make them brighter and have them reflect more sunlight.
Wow. Let me pick up on the Mount Pinatubo, which was back in 1991. And I guess, Alan, the impact of Pinatubo has given a lot of people, I'm assuming yourself as well, some things to think about because of its effect on the planet and its effect on climate.
The global average temperatures went down by about a degree Fahrenheit for a couple of years, so it shows that this cloud could cool the planet. At the same time, it reduced precipitation, especially over the monsoon regions, and there was much less rain over India and China and North Africa in the year following it, which might have a threat to the food supply, to crops. In addition, it destroyed ozone. The tiny particles allowed reactions in the stratosphere so that chlorine was released, and it destroyed ozone. So there was more diffuse radiation, not direct radiation, reaching the surface, and that reduced solar power in those devices that use direct radiation. It also had an impact on plants. So there were a lot of good and negative aspects to it. And again, we have to weigh all these to see, is the cooling worth all these other risks?
And going back to you, Jeff Goodall, you interviewed a number of people for your book. What got you interested in geoengineering?
Well, I had written a book about the coal industry, the global coal industry, and it became clear to me that at the end of that book, we weren't going to stop burning coal anytime soon. And that had profound implications for you know, this whole idea that we were ever going to reduce CO2 emissions. So I began to think about, you know, well, what are we going to do? You know, how are we, what's the future going to look like if we're not going to reduce CO2 emissions? And then I heard about this idea of geoengineering from a physicist at Lawrence Livermore Lab, and it struck me as a completely crazy idea. And nevertheless, the one that that, you know, we might be forced into. So I spent a couple of years basically exploring, you know, whether or not this is as crazy an idea as it first seemed. And my basic conclusion was no. I mean, it's like half crazy idea. but the real revelation was that the people who were thinking about this, like people like Allen and like David Keith at Harvard and Ken Caldera at Stanford and many others, are deeply serious scientists who are deeply serious about looking at this as a way to potentially reduce risk. And it's an idea that we need to take very, very seriously.
Well, and have crazy ideas, you know, there's a lot that can be said for them, Alan Robach.
Well, it's good to have ideas. It's
yes.
good to evaluate ideas. I first heard about this. I went to my first conference in 2006 at NASA after Paul Crutzen had written his article. And when I was having dinner the night before the conference, a friend of mine said, "Did you see the latest Rolling Stone?" And it had Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart on the cover, but inside was Jeff's article about, "Can Dr. Evil save the world from global warming?" And that was a very comprehensive, very interesting article, which gave me a great introduction to the topic.
Well, indeed, it's an article that caught our eye, and we're almost up in a break here, Jeff, but this is an article about a guy named Lowell Wood.
Right, who was the protege of Edward Teller, the right. sort of godfather of the hydrogen bomb at Lawrence Livermore Lab, and a well-known figure in during the Cold War. Lowell was involved in things like the ill-fated Star Wars idea of using lasers to knock out Soviet missiles and things like that. And Lowell is a quite brilliant physicist and also quite provocative and kind of out there on the fringe. And it was him that first, you know, kind of brought this idea up to me. And I have to say, it really was an eye-opening moment spending a few hours talking to Lowell about this idea of manipulating the entire Earth's climate.
Mm. Well, we are talking about manipulating the Earth's planet, geoengineering, talking with Jeff Goodall, and he's a journalist, a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine, wrote a book called How to Cool the Planet. Also with us, Alan Robach. He's a climatologist at Rutgers University in the Department of Environmental Sciences. What do you think about geoengineering? Any questions, comments, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival presents the Richard Thompson Electric Trio, Todd Rundgren, the David Bromberg Quintet, the Mavericks, Asleep at the Wheel, the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and many more. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, kids' activities, and camping, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 15th through 18th on the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford. For tickets and festival information, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back with a day of free live music featuring They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. The WHYY Connections Festival is free for everyone, and WHYY members and sustainers get exclusive access to the Member Oasis tent all day long. They Might Be Giants and more, Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza. For a full lineup and to register, visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
Next time in Studio 360, you want to know what a war zone is really like? Just look on Vine, where U.S. troops are making six-second movies about their lives.
Being deployed has its downtime.
You guys want to see what Afghanistan looks like?
We got dirt.
We got piles of dirt. What's that over there?
Dirt.
Soldier Vines. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the prospects, the perils of geoengineering. Again, Alan Robach, our guest, a climatologist at Rutgers University in the Department of Environmental Sciences, author of hundreds of articles, peer-reviewed papers on this and other science-related topics, and Jeff Goodall, a journalist contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine, author of How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering, and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate. And again, taking calls, any questions or comments you might have, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Alan, going back to you, and as you said, you read Jeff's article about Lowell Wood, and this is an article about a Pentagon weapon developer who was interested in geoengineering. Did that give you pause? Did that inspire you to think that there's someone with that kind of thinking is thinking about geoengineering?
Well, Lowell was actually at this meeting, this two-day meeting at NASA, and so I got to meet him, and Jeff's description was quite accurate. And there were these people who were quite enthusiastic about this idea, mainly engineer and physicist types. And at this meeting, I started writing down reasons why this might not be such a good idea, and I came up with 20 reasons. Well,
we seem to have lost Alan Robach. Let's see if we can get him back. Jeff, if I can get you to, I guess, carry on, perhaps you can even describe what Lowell Wood was working on.
Well, Lowell had been, along with Edward Teller, who I mentioned was the sort of godfather of the hydrogen bomb, had been working on far-out ideas like they were very interested in space exploration, and he is very interested in space exploration. And one of the kind of craziest ideas he had was actually, you know, launching mirrors way out into space that would act as a kind of like window louvers for sunlight, and then you could essentially, you know, control the Earth's climate through these louvers that were out at this place in space called a Lagrange point, which would be the most efficient and simple place for these mirrors to be stationed. It was a completely far-out, crazy idea that would cost trillions and trillions of dollars and would never happen. But it led Lowell and Teller to start thinking about other ideas about how this might manipulate the Earth's climate. And I have to say that I don't know what exactly their motives were. Mm-hmm. They were involved in military and weapons development and things, and neither one of them were, at that time, very deeply concerned about climate change, so they were thinking about it for other reasons. But it became clear to other scientists that this was an interesting idea, and the idea of volcanoes as analogs then occurred to some people, including Lowell Wood, and people like Alan Robach then picked up the thought about this and really began exploring this idea of putting these sulfate particles into the stratosphere via probably the most likely scenarios with airplanes. They would act as tiny, tiny mirrors to reflect away just a little bit of sunlight, and all you'd have to do is just reflect away, say, 1% of the sunlight that hits the planet to offset a doubling of CO2. And it became a very provocative idea and is now, you know, something that, you know, is being explored.
But it is the idea of spraying these particles from hoses out of 747s, and that's part of what you were writing, Jeff.
Well, yeah, the idea of using 747s has kind of evolved now. There's other kinds of high-altitude aircraft that would be more efficient and better at it. But, yes, it's essentially sending aircraft high up into the stratosphere and spraying sulfate particles either in the form of sulfuric acid gas, sort of like volcanoes do, or some other medium, and putting a small amount of these particles up into the stratosphere. We don't need very much, and you could pretty clearly and pretty simply, you know, lower the temperature of the planet.
Alan, we have you back. For some reason, we lost you. Now we have you back, and it sounds like you want to add something.
Oh, yeah, my power went out, and it killed my other phone.
Okay. Well, we're keeping our fingers. We're talking about geoengineering, and I feel like we're held together by rubber bands here as we're talking on the radio. But, Alan, go ahead.
Well, that's just an example. Will we trust the planet to a technology that has to work perfectly, that's run by humans and built by humans? That's one of the scary things about this whole idea. But as Jeff said, 747s can't get into the stratosphere in the tropics, so you can imagine other types of planes that could take the sulfur up there. But there's still a question about, can you create a cloud with the right properties, with the right size of the little droplets that would be effective at scattering sunlight? Can you create a cloud where the droplets wouldn't actually grow and fall out pretty quickly? So the technical aspects of it are still quite unclear. It's not clear we could actually ever do it.
But does it make sense, Alan, though, to at least investigate it or even invest in it? I mean, it may be half crazy, but is the other half is that it's half sane?
I'm all in favor of research. We have to know that we have the idea. The idea can't go away. The research is very cheap. It's a few million dollars a year that the different countries around the world are spending. It's intimately connected to climate research. At the same time, we learn about the effects of volcanic eruptions on climate. So, yes, we have to know there are ethical aspects about research. Are you taking resources away from something else more productive? Are you leading to a slippery slope to deployment? But I think the idea comes down on doing the research so that we can have the information and make informed decisions.
Well, going back to you, Jeff, and one of the arguments I've heard against geoengineering is that it doesn't stop the use of fossil fuels. The idea is that you can continue to use fossil fuels and then just use geoengineering to deal with the consequences, thereby, you know, not addressing the cause of climate change.
Yeah, I heard that argument a lot, too. Well, first of all, I mean, it's not like we're doing a great job of cutting use of fossil fuels now anyway, so it's not like there's a huge risk there in that sense. But you can certainly see, and I've experienced this myself, and perhaps Alan has too, but I mean, you know, if you get, you know, big oil companies, if ExxonMobil starts touting geoengineering or Peabody Energy, the biggest coal provider in the world, starts touting geoengineering, that becomes a very scary idea. If it becomes just a sort of, like I mentioned earlier, kind of diet pill where you can, you know, keep eating your giant bowls of coal and oil and natural gas and think we're going to fix it all just by sending a few jets up there and spraying sulfate particles, that's awful. But if it becomes part of a intelligent risk management scenario where we're down ramping on CO2 emissions as quickly as we can, and through the work of Alan and others, become to understand that putting a small amount of particles in the stratosphere helps reduce the risk of climate change, helps with things like drought and slows the melting of the glaciers in the Arctic, perhaps. Then it might be an intelligent part of our response to climate change.
You want to add
this moral hazard argument that people will give up on mitigation if they think geoengineering is going to solve it can work the other way, too. It turns out when you tell people about geoengineering, most people have never heard about it, and they say, you're going to do that? You're going to do that to solve this problem? It must actually be a real problem. And sometimes people become more believers in global warming if they realize that people are seriously considering geoengineering.
One of the questions I ran across, I'll toss this to both of you, and then we'll get some callers in on the conversation to you, Alan. One of the questions of geoengineering is, you know, who controls the global thermostat, if I can use that? Are countries working in concert to address their particular problems? Are there the sort of unintended legal and perhaps even more economic consequences of geoengineering, and who controls that?
Absolutely right. That was one of the things on my original list of 20 reasons. Whose hands on the thermostat? What if Russia and Canada don't mind it a couple degrees warmer, yet islands in the Pacific are already drowning and want it even cooler than it is now? How could the planet decide?
Yeah.
We don't know of any techniques right now that can control regional climate, so it could set a thermostat one way in one country and another way in another country. All these techniques are sort of controlling the global climate, and these regional patterns are all connected. Maybe some research in the future will allow each country to have their own little room-sized thermostat to control it, but we don't know of any techniques now that would do that because the whole atmosphere is connected.
Right. And I mean, but won't it always be connected?
It'll be connected, but you could, like, for example, produce clouds over one place and not over another place. Over the ocean, you could brighten clouds only in one place, and it could have sort of a regional impact and counteract some of the global. You could be doing it in the stratosphere globally, and then you could have additional little things in different places where you brighten clouds in some places and not in other places to balance the bad impacts. And people are thinking about how you can do that. Is it even possible to do that? And it's not clear that it is, but people are going to try and figure it out.
Yeah, to you, Jeff, the question about the global thermostat, your thoughts?
Yeah, two thoughts. One is that as far as regional impacts, so one example of a potentially useful possibility of this is Alan mentioned the idea of cloud brightening of marine clouds over the oceans. And one idea might be to brighten clouds over coral reefs where to cool them down where they're being impacted by the rising ocean temperatures and acidification of the oceans. That might be an example of a small regional impact or program that might work and have a lot of obvious benefits. But as far as the sort of, you know, whose hand is on a thermostat, it's a really complicated question, and it brings up a lot of the old Cold War nuclear, you know, crazy man's finger on the trigger kind of arguments. And because it's clear that, you know, one country, one lone actor, one group of countries, one billionaire for that matter, could have a profound impact on the entire climate of the planet. And there are essentially no treaties, no laws, no governance at all of this idea, which is one reason why it needs to be talked about openly, it needs to be taken seriously, and people need to think about governance structures for this.
And that's why we're talking about all of this on Radio Times, the prospects, the perils, the pros and the cons of geoengineering. That's Jeff Goodall. He's a journalist, contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine, author of a book called How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering, and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate. Alan Robuck is a climatologist at Rutgers University in the Department of Environmental Sciences, author of numerous hundreds of articles, peer-reviewed papers on this issue and issues related to climate change. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You have a flavor for what we're talking about. We want to get your reaction. Let me see what Joe from Pittstown, New Jersey has to say. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. You're on the air, Joe?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I think the conversation for the last 5 minutes is sort of answering my question, because I'll drive to work on Route 78 for about 30 miles, and when I get to work, I'll walk into the building and I'll see a clear blue sky, but I'll see planes up in the air kicking out what I used to consider condensation trails, but I'll come out for a break from work and I'll see clouds in the sky. Now, I wonder if the guests, if they think or suspect that experimentation is already going on, and that's one question. The second thing is, if it is, what effects does it have on health for people who are below those clouds?
Well, let me get an answer to your first question, which will probably answer your second one. And let me toss that first to you, Alan Robuck.
This is the idea of chemtrails people look at contrails, condensation trails from jet airplanes, and think that the government is spraying on purpose to try and control the climate. There's no evidence for that at all. This is just water that condenses in the exhaust of jet airplanes. Out west, where the skies are clear, you see them more often. That's where people think about this more. But there's no evidence of that. We're not doing it in the atmosphere at all. There are ideas of experiments that people might want to do, controlled experiments, not in the troposphere, but up in the stratosphere. But there have been none that have taken place that I know of.
Well, Jeff, and just keying off of Joe's question, I mean, are there some conspiracy theories about what the government or perhaps even big business is already doing?
Oh, there's lots of conspiracy theories. I mean, everywhere I go to talk about this, I'm sure Alan has the same experience, is people ask about these chemtrails and this idea that it's already going on, that it's a secret government project, that there's some kind of a covert program already happening, and you know, trust me, I write for Rolling Stone magazine. If this were going on, I would be all over it. And I have spent a lot of time with scientists at all levels of this, and yeah, there's absolutely no evidence of
of this going on. It's just a straightforward conspiracy idea, and there's nothing to it.
And there's nothing to it. But it is interesting, Jeff. Some of the people that you interviewed and some of the research that I did does show that there is interest from the Pentagon. There's interest from business, even some conservative think tanks I read about, that some of whom have been climate deniers are interested in geoengineering. What should we make of that?
Well, I think that there is a real the real danger, and the real, if there is a conspiracy, which I would not say that there is, but the real danger here is, as I mentioned earlier, that the sort of fossil fuel interests, the big oil companies, the big coal companies, and the politicians who support them will get behind, and the conservatives, others who either think that global warming is not happening or that it's not really a threat, will embrace geoengineering as a way to keep burning fossil fuels for another 20 or 30 years and to diffuse the political momentum for things like carbon taxes or cap and trade programs or any other things that would help us to reduce our consumption of fossil fuels. So I think that's the sort of, if there is a kind of political dark side to this, I definitely think it's that. And I think that's a real and present danger.
Let me see what Lauren from West Philadelphia has to say. Lauren, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yeah, I was just curious about side effects and, you know, especially like to wildlife, plant life, agriculture, like what kind of thought has been given to that, and that's it.
Side effects from what?
Oh, just introducing these sulfate particles into the atmosphere, just blowing, you know, huge amounts of this chemical, I guess, into the atmosphere. Seems like there could be other effects than the intended ones.
Well, Lauren, it's a good question. I'm going to toss that to you, Alan Roebuck.
The idea is, as Jeff said, if you want to reduce about 1% of the sunlight, you might put about 5 million tons of SO2 gas into the stratosphere every year. Now, it turns out that volcanoes put about 13 million tons into the lower atmosphere every year just by emissions like from Kilauea, Mount Etna. Humans put about 100 million tons of SO2 in as a byproduct of burning fossil fuels. This is what produces our air pollution and acid rain. So we're talking about adding maybe 5% to the already amount in the atmosphere. So compared to that, the sulfur itself wouldn't be that dangerous. What we are looking at, though, is the regional climate change. If you're trying to cool the planet and the summer monsoons over Asia and Africa, even North America, become weaker, that might have an impact on agriculture. So we've organized all the climate modeling groups in the world to do the same experiment to analyze these patterns, and we've just submitted a bunch of papers on it. And it does look like the summer monsoons would get weaker if you're trying to keep the global temperature constant. At the same time, though, evaporation would go down because it would be cooler, and so it's not clear that it would negatively affect the crops, and we're still trying to figure that out. But we want to look at the regional impacts on agriculture and on water supply. Those are the really important things.
Well, we need to take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about geoengineering with Alan Roebuck and Jeff Goodall, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Questions or comments, give us a call. Again, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Cornwall Manor, an active senior living community in Cornwall, Lebanon County. Situated on a 190-acre wooded campus, this community offers independence, wellness, and fitness activities, educational and musical programs, and the peace of mind of on-site health care if needed. Cornwall Manor's range of residential choices includes apartments and homes, including their newest options, the Carriage House and the Grove. Details and tour information online at cornwallmanor.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Jenji Kohan, the creator of the new Netflix series Orange is the New Black. It's based on the memoir of the same name by Piper Kerman, who was sent to prison for having carried drug money. The series tells the stories of the diverse women in the prison. Kohan also created the Showtime series Weeds. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Boycott the Russian Olympics or protest with Olympic gold.
Who would Greg Louganis be without his Olympic gold medals? I'd just be another person, a noise in the crowd.
Four-time Olympic gold medalist Greg Louganis speaks above the noise on how to confront anti-gay laws in Russia. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about geoengineering in this hour of the show. What if humans could control the weather, the climate, the floods, the droughts, the temperature extremes that have been plaguing much of the world in recent years? Talking with Alan Robach. He's a climatologist at Rutgers University. Jeff Goodall, a journalist, author of How to Cool the Planet, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Louise and Louise calling us from Wayne, Pennsylvania. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I'm calling from Wayne.
Yes.
And I go to a nutritionist, and my I've been having increasing troubles this year with sulfites. A lot of people are allergic to sulfites, including me. And he says that he's had a lot of patients coming in this year with increased sulfite allergies, and that is indeed due to spraying sulfites from jet trails into the upper atmosphere.
Well, Louisa, let me take your call just because it sounds a little bit like what we heard from Joe earlier, and if I can toss that, I guess, back to you, Alan Robach.
There's no evidence for that. I'm not even sure what she means by sulfites. Has anybody ever been to an airport and seen tanks of chemicals being loaded into commercial airplanes to spray into the atmosphere? It just doesn't exist. I feel bad for her medical issues, but it's not caused by chemtrails. It's not caused by the government spraying anything.
But, you know, Jeff, this really taps into, a deep suspicion about this notion of trying to control the weather, trying to control climate, and, you know, this notion of, you know, who's behind the global thermostat, and just a great deal of skepticism about not just the technology, but the sort of evil doers behind all this potential technology.
It does, I struggle to kind of understand that, but it certainly does speak to the larger fears that would certainly become more and more obvious and present if and when we start doing some field experiments to see how some of this technology would work. I mean, you can imagine a scenario where we do a small field experiment in Arizona, and farmers in Texas start blaming them for problems with the wheat crop or something. I mean, once you inject intentionality into the manipulation of the climate, then there's all kinds of questions about consequences and how do you determine whether or not what was done here had an effect there, and if this is to blame for whatever weather problem or catastrophe comes our way, which is sort of ironic because we're doing that now, right? We're putting billions of tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every year intentionally. We know that it has climate effects, and yet no one is blaming a particular person for Hurricane Sandy or anything like that. But once we start doing geoengineering, that kind of false naivete will end.
Well, and I wonder, Alan, how this affects the kind of research that you have been doing and even the skepticism, and it's pretty much been discredited, the skepticism about global warming. How does that affect the kind of work that you do?
I do indoor research using computer models and data analysis, but there have been proposals for outdoor experiments. In England, the SPICE project attempted to hang a hose from a balloon half a mile up into the atmosphere and spray water out. And when people found out about that, the protests made them cancel this experiment. Mm. So anything even innocuous like that, it probably wasn't that great an idea anyway, but people protested it. So as Jeff said, what if we started doing geoengineering and there was a catastrophic failure, the Indian monsoon, or or hurricanes somewhere, people might blame the geoengineers on that, and society would be forced to stop doing it. If we'd been doing it for a while and then stopped, you'd get catastrophic global warming at a rate much faster than we're getting now without doing anything. So that's another concern. Let me just say something about the CIA.
Yes, please.
The National Academy of Sciences is conducting a two-year study of geoengineering right now, and some of the funding is coming from the CIA as well as other government agencies, and that has been characterized as quite suspicious. What the CIA is trying to learn about controlling the planet's climate, what's wrong with that? But the CIA called me up last year and wanted to know if some other country was currently trying to control the planet, control the climate of the planet, would we know about it? So they're concerned about that, and my answer was yes, we would, because if you put a cloud thick enough up in the atmosphere to block out the sun to really have an impact on climate, we'd be able to detect it with our current satellites and ground instruments, because we can already see the effects of small volcanic eruptions. If they were brightening clouds somewhere, we would see that with satellites. So it's rightly a concern. Is somebody else trying to do that, or if it's somebody else is doing it in their interest, what would you think about it?
Well, should we be worried about temperature wars, Jeff?
Well, I don't know that we should be worried about temperature wars, but I think that we need to take very seriously the possibility that in the next decade or so, someone is going to try this. I think that, you know, as we know, when politicians get into dangerous situations where they feel a lot of pressure from their constituents to do something about a problem, they do something, whether it's a good idea or not. I mean, you know, weather modification in the sense of trying to produce rainfall is a good example. China has a huge program to, you know, produce rainfall in various agricultural regions of the country, and there's very little evidence that it works at all, but they have jets flying around and shooting missiles into the sky and things, and they do it for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is that it's a way of showing farmers that the government is trying to do something about this problem, and the fact that it doesn't really work doesn't really matter. And you can imagine a similar scenario evolving with geoengineering, where we're forced, or a politician or someone is forced to start doing this simply because it looks good politically to be actually taking action. And, you know, if you get into a situation where we need to take action now, you know, it's not going to be, okay, well, everybody sell your SUVs and get a skateboard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be something like this. And we need to prepare for that. And that means thinking about governance and treaties. It also means, I think, pushing harder on research, both of the kind that Alan does with models, also with better observing and preparing for observing at the next volcano eruption, and I think subscale field research, field experiments, where you're actually injecting some of this stuff on a very small scale into the atmosphere and seeing the reaction.
Alan, I'd be curious about your response to what Jeff just said.
I agree with everything he said except for the last part about outdoor experiments. I'm not sure we should be doing outdoor experiments at this point. Why would we be doing them? What would we be testing? If we were going to do it at a scale, you'd have to demonstrate that it's not going to be dangerous, and that means you'd need some sort of governance, somebody else evaluating your environmental impact statement and making sure that what you're proposing is not going to be dangerous, and that you'll get more science compared to the pollution you're putting in the atmosphere. And there is no such mechanism to do that right now. So it would have to be a very well-designed and controlled experiment, and you'd have to be able, if the scientist at the end of it said, well, I got sort of inconclusive results, so let me do it twice as long or put twice as much material in or over twice an area, you'd have to be able to stop that and say, no, you agreed to do this. So I still have not seen an argument for a specific experiment that would be designed to really learn very much that would make more sense. There are some things we just can't test outdoors because they're too dangerous. Nuclear weapons, of course, is a prime example.
Indeed, and that's Alan Robach. He's a climatologist at Rutgers University. Also with us, Jeff Goodall, a journalist, author of How to Cool the Planet. We're talking about geoengineering. I'm Marty Moscow, and you're listening to Radio Times right here on WHYY. Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Michael calling us from Atlanta, Georgia. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. We've mostly talked about, you know, the overall temperature of the planet, but has there been much progress in terms of trying to mitigate more of the symptoms, such as drought and more severe weather.
The idea of using geoengineering to deal with that, is that what you're asking?
Yes, right. So more of the symptoms as opposed to the overall cause.
To look at the, some of the symptoms. Can I toss that to you, Alan Roebuck?
Yeah, some of the things we're concerned about with global warming are more severe storms, sea level rise, droughts in certain areas. And all of these things are tied to the global temperature. So because it's warming, there's more evaporation, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, and that's the fuel for storms. Sandy was more dangerous because of global warming, because sea level is a little bit higher now than it would have been without global warming, and so the water came farther inland. Mm-hmm. The storm itself was a little bit stronger because it had more water vapor. And so controlling the global temperature would dampen out all of these things. That's a much easier way to do it than to try to pick out a particular thing. Now, there are ideas for hurricane modification, which there's a whole program. There was a whole program of that. It hasn't been figured out how to do that. People have thought about taking specific things like hurricanes and controlling them, but there's no evidence that we really know how to do that.
But, Alan, even if we were to do all the things that we have been talking about and to do them tomorrow, how quickly would we begin to cool the planet?
It's a really hard problem because mitigation is, if you everybody stopped emitting CO2 tomorrow, you wouldn't see any difference for decades. This is something people are being asked to do so that their children and grandchildren will have a better life. And it's really hard to make that trade-off when you have many more immediate concerns. That's why it's such a difficult problem and why it hasn't been solved yet. It's not like turning off a dirty smokestack and tomorrow you have clean air. The carbon dioxide lasts in the atmosphere for a long time. The heat takes a long time to go in and out of the ocean, and so it's a very long-term problem. And that's why it's so difficult to solve.
Let me get, looks like Jim from Morrisville to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Incredible topic.
Thanks.
I'm an engineer. I'm a father. I have great concerns for the impact that the human race has been having on this planet. I worry about my kids. Now, you were talking about skepticism earlier, and I'm a huge proponent of anything we can do technologically to help control the atmosphere, global warming, so forth and so on, but I've been hearing about environmental issues, environmental concerns since I was in elementary school. I'm 47. I don't really know that the corporate America has been doing a whole lot to cut down on emissions. I think that you guys had talked earlier about whether if we are somehow able to get control over the environment through technology, would that cut back on companies trying to, you know, decrease emissions? I guess I'm very jaded, but I think that...
Well, you know, Jim, we're losing your phone call. And let me take it, let me put it to you, Jeff Goodall, because there has been some progress when it comes to energy efficiencies, hasn't there been?
Oh, sure. There's been huge progress when it comes to energy efficiency. There's been a lot of progress in renewable energy. We're seeing big uptake in wind in certain parts of the country. Solar panels are dropping in price radically. There's certainly many, many sort of bright notes in this story. But the problem is, globally, when you look at it by the only measure that really matters, which is the amount of CO2 going into the atmosphere globally, we're not doing a very good job. In fact, we're not doing anything at all. Mm. And so as we're starting to see these climate impacts becoming more and more real, more and more happening in real time, and as Alan said, even if we cut emissions to zero tomorrow, it's not going to fix things. So
Hold on one sec. Just finish your thought, Jeff, and then we'll go to you, Alan. Go ahead, Jeff.
We don't know what kind of world we're moving into, and if we get into really nasty surprises with the climate, something like geoengineering, which can have a very immediate effect on lowering the temperature of the Earth and reducing the heat, might be something that we need to think about.
What do you think, Alan?
Well, if we did cut emissions, it would fix things, and it would just take a while. And so that is what we have to do. The problem, as Jeff said, is if we have dangerous things in the meantime, we might be tempted to temporarily do geoengineering until the reduction of CO2 kicks in. And so we have to stop emitting, and we have to figure out maybe ways to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, but we're not doing we're not, the mission continues and continues, and that has, that's the first thing we have to do.
And Ellen, we have about a minute and a half before we have to say goodbye. So what specifically are you working on now that is related to geoengineering?
Well, we've organized all these different climate modeling groups in the world who do these standard experiments, and we're planning new experiments. We're trying to figure out if we did it in certain ways, how would it really affect us? What would be the benefits and what would be the risks?
So the, and no, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So we're talking about you and others. You're basically using computer models. So you're looking at,
yes,
your computer screens.
We're also studying volcanic eruptions to see what we can learn from that. I'm not doing any outdoor experiments. I'm just doing data analysis and computer modeling.
And Jeff, you won an award for your book. Are you done with geoengineering, or is there more that interests you?
No, there's a lot more that interests me. I'm working on another big article about it now. And I think the real questions for the media future are this question about outdoor field experiments, whether or not they can be done and should be done, and how they will be governed, and also these larger questions about how we begin to assemble any kind of governance structure to begin thinking about this in this political world.
Well, much to think about and talk about. Jeff Goodall, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Journalist and contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine, author of How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering, and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate. Alan Robuck, thank you very much as well.
You're welcome.
And deteriorating phone lines as we talk about geoengineering. Alan Robuck, climatologist at Rutgers University in the Department of Environmental Sciences. Our intern Nick Sessler produced this interview, a great way to end his summer internship here at Radio Times. Nick, thanks for all your help. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program and stay with us for hour two.